this meeting a little early. We don't have a quorum, but when we have one, we'll announce it. And with that, we were going to ask three testifiers to come up to the table at the same time. We have Deputy Commissioner Jeremy Hansen Wills. And we have Ann Kelser. It used to be Olson.
It did used to be Olson, sir.
And Connie Ireland, welcome. Friend, face from the past. Please, whoever wants to start, give their name for the record, and we're anxious to hear what pearls of wisdom come out of your mouths.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeremy Hansen Willis. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Development at the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, and we're very happy to be here this afternoon and appreciate the invitation to talk a little bit about our state workforce development system, and in particular the state workforce centers around the state, and give a little bit more information about how we think all these pieces fit together. As you know, the Minnesota's workforce development system has a myriad of players in concert together to provide workforce development for people from the early ages of youth all the way through adulthood. As you've spent a lot of time talking about at this committee, and as our department has reported previously, we feel that in order for Minnesota to continue to be economically competitive, we must continue to develop the world's best workforce, and that takes many players in order for us to accomplish, especially given the challenges we have today with the small status of our labor force and the difficulty that many employers are having in hiring people in that situation.
When you say small status, what are you referring to?
Mr. Chair,
lack of numbers or what?
Due to primarily the retirement of our baby boomers, we are seeing a flattening in the growth of our labor force in Minnesota.
So we want to encourage anybody to get into it, right?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. This is the time when we need to be able to utilize every possible person in Minnesota's workforce and make sure that they have the skills that they need to meet the demands of our growing economy and businesses.
Okay, go ahead.
There are many components to Minnesota's workforce development system, everything from K-12 education, higher education, community colleges, our workforce centers around the state, community-based nonprofits, and various trainers all working together to help make sure that we have a competitive workforce. At the core of this, and one thing we'll be talking in greater detail about today, are the 48 workforce centers located all across the state, which are hubs for many of the services that we provide to help develop Minnesota's workforce. These workforce centers serve not only youth and adult job seekers, but also businesses and employers looking to expand and fill their jobs. As a department, DEED has a very specific role, but we are only one player in this matrix of workforce development systems, and we work very closely both with K-12 and with higher ed, as well as many of the organizations that I mentioned all across the state. In Minnesota, one of the challenges that we have, not only with a small growth or a flat growth in our labor force, but at the same time as we are struggling with that reality, we also know that too many of our populations face barriers to employment and have disparities in employment. DEED's larger role primarily is to provide a continuum of services at very specific points in people's lives. And again, DEED as the state government is but one player, but we're a very significant player and we play very important roles at specific times in people's lives. And we especially try to focus our federal and especially our state programs on those populations that have barriers to employment, especially in this very low unemployment situation. The people who are still unemployed are those who have barriers to getting into employment and require additional help. Our training programs are therefore specifically designed to provide assistance to exactly these populations. And while we know there's always room for improvement and we strive every day to improve, as I'm sure you've heard in this committee before, Minnesota is considered a model, a workforce development system around the country. We have a very robust system, and by all and many performance measures by the federal government, we exceed, if not set the pace for many states around the country. And again, we deliver our services not only through workforce centers, but community-based organizations, Minsky campuses, and all basic education.
Mr. Hansen-Wills, could you help me out. Where's the workforce center in the metro area? Is there one in St. Paul or Minneapolis?
Mr. Chair, yes, there are two in Minneapolis and two in St. Paul. And perhaps I should have prefaced before I began talking, but over the course of our presentations today, we're going to be talking in great detail about the Workforce Center system. My role initially is to give the committee a bit of an overview at a high level of Minnesota's workforce development system. And then my colleagues here will go into a little bit more detail about how those services play out at a local level. And we'll talk about the Governor's Workforce Council and a recent report we submitted to the legislature in January, which provides an overview and an update and a look to the future of our 48 workforce centers all around the state. Now, at the same time as we have a robust and growing economy and many of our employers are finding it difficult to hire employees and fill vacancies, we know that at the same time, this is primarily because of the aging of our workforce. And over the next 10 years, about 500,000 Minnesotans will enter retirement and take with them their knowledge and skills and experience. And at a time where the labor force is not growing to meet that demand, many employers around the state are finding it very difficult to fill their positions. And this low unemployment rate is not just going to be a blip on the screen, we believe, but is going to be the reality of Minnesota's workforce and economic development for the next couple of decades. And so our ability to keep our economy growing and strong with a low unemployment and flat growth in the labor force is our greatest challenge. One of the main solutions to this is to make sure that every Minnesotan has the skills and the ability to enter the workforce and become independent and self-sufficient. And unfortunately, at the same time as we have this growing economy and low unemployment, some of our populations are facing higher unemployment. The overall unemployment in Minnesota right now is about 3.7%. But for African-American Minnesotans, for example, that's 11.4% unemployment. For people with disabilities in Minnesota, it's about a 15% unemployment rate, and even more severe for certain types of disabilities. Our young people under the age of 24 in Minnesota have an almost 10% unemployment rate. And so these are just examples of the fact that even with the low overall unemployment, we have pockets of much higher unemployment that we have to address. And if we are able to successfully address, can help meet the needs of our employers and our growing businesses. Another category of the unemployed that's sort of a tale of the recession is our long-term unemployed, people who have been unemployed for 6 months or longer. And of the overall unemployment, about 27% of those folks have been unemployed for 6 months or longer, and 17% have been unemployed a year or longer. And so these are folks who previously were in the workforce.
How many was that a year or longer?
I'm sorry, Mr.
Chair. How many was that a year or longer?
It was 17% have been unemployed for 1 year or longer. That's 17% of the overall unemployed in our state.
How about those people just flat gave up?
That, Mr. Chair, in addition to that number, there are populations that are not counted in unemployment, which are folks who have given up, who have lost hope, and aren't even looking for work. This percentage of people and how we calculate unemployment are people who are actively looking for work but are unable to currently find employment. It also doesn't necessarily take into account people who might be part-time employed or underemployed or employed in an area that's not really their career of choice. And so while the 3.7% is an important indication of overall unemployment, it is important to look at some of these other factors of alternative employment.
What is the USEC's method of determining unemployment? What is our number there?
I'm sorry, Mr.
USEC, you're talking about U3 when you're talking about 3.7%, because those are people getting a check. Of all the people that are working part-time, that are falling off the 26-week ladder, gave up looking for a job, what is the total number of people that are unemployed or considering themselves unemployed?
Mr. Chair, I'm afraid that I don't have that number particularly at the top of my head right now, but we'd be able to easily get that to you.
Would you get that to the committee so they
Absolutely.
Can see that?
Yes.
Thank you. I think we did have Representative Sertich a couple years ago when Governor Plenty was here requested that was given to the chairman. Evidently, when Plenty left, that left. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I have a question. Do you have any of the parameters that you determine how you determine unemployment changed over the last, particularly since the 07, the time of the beginning of the recession? Have you changed any parameters, like in local government aid, how many accidents you have in a community, how many traffic tickets, how many pre-40 housing, if you're looking at local government aid? Have any of those parameters changed which would skew the number in any way up or down in recent years, particularly since the recession?
Mr. Chair, members, to my knowledge, no, that the way that unemployment is calculated has not only been consistent in Minnesota, but all around the country to help us ensure that longitudinal statistics can be accurate.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, in addition to the other disparities I've mentioned.
Excuse me 1 minute.
Yes.
We have a quorum now, so we're officially meet. And while we're at it, Representative Dill, did you read the
minutes?
I should have known. Representative Mahoney moves the minutes of February, what is it? Where's the date? January 29th. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passed. Now we're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For your patience.
Now, at the same time that we have some of these other disparities in our employment in Minnesota based on race, disability, youth, et cetera, we also know that the experience of employment and unemployment varies greatly all around the state. And rather than a state economy, we have a series of regional economies around Minnesota. And a particular note to this committee, we know that there's a very different experience in the metro area versus greater Minnesota, where the difficulty to hire is often worse in greater Minnesota, and the unemployment rates vary greatly all around the state. We know that these demographic changes have a bigger impact, as I said, in greater Minnesota. Greater Minnesotans also tend to be older than metro area residents, and so the impact of the aging of our population is often felt worse in many rural parts of the state, and a greater percentage of our households in rural areas are senior households. So these demographic changes are being even more strongly felt in greater Minnesota. We also know that the median annual household income in greater Minnesota is less than that in the Twin Cities, that the educational attainment gap between the metro and outstate workforces has also persisted over some time, and expanding access to education and training is therefore increasingly important for us to be able to provide this throughout the state, not just in the metro area, and in fact perhaps even more important in some of these areas where there is greater need. So our presentation today therefore is going to focus on the services that are provided at the local level. Part of Minnesota's very robust workforce development system requires us to have very strong relationships between state agencies and the state government and local communities and local service providers that are the ones that provide the job counseling and provide the services at the local level. And at the core of this are the 48 workforce centers all around Minnesota. And as much as these centers are the backbone of all of the services that we provide to help unemployed people get connected to employment and training to further themselves in their career, we know that the system can also be constantly improved, especially at a time where people travel great distances to sometimes get to a workforce center, especially at a time where unemployed people often go online before they'll go to a building to find job search information or support or counseling. And we know that our workforce centers need to meet the needs of the current technology, meet the needs of our current job seekers, and meet the needs of our businesses in this new environment of low unemployment and labor shortage. So we have been working as a State Department with our local partners all around the state to look at reinventing the workforce center in Minnesota. And my colleagues will be talking in greater detail about that. But there are really four overarching goals that we believe that will frame our work together to bring our workforce centers into the modern era and meet the needs of our current economic environment. First of all, as I said, we believe that we need to, in fact, reinvent and modernize the workforce center system, including increase to online education and electronic services. Second, we need to better meet the needs of our employers in our workforce centers. The perception and the reality, I think, is that the workforce centers are there to serve job seekers, the unemployed Minnesotans who need help getting back into employment. But the reality is that we also provide services to employers and look to increase and improve our services to employers so that they have an access and a pipeline to the unemployed folks in Minnesota who are connecting through our workforce centers. And so we're looking at ways that the Workforce Center system can better meet the needs of our employers. Thirdly, we're also looking to increase alignment, connection, and communication with our various partners. Even though we desire the Workforce Centers to be central hubs where job seekers and employers can both go to get connected to each other, the reality is in many parts of our state, these services are provided by independent nonprofit organizations or various forms of government that aren't always as connected. And how do we make sure that Minsky campuses or public libraries or nonprofit organizations can all be better connected and aligned in this system to make it easier, and there are fewer points of entry and fewer points of contact for job seekers and employers? And fourth and lastly, our goal is to make sure to raise the awareness and the use of this Workforce Center system by exactly these populations. As many as 250,000 Minnesotans go into a Workforce Center every year. And while that's a lot of folks, we know that on average in Minnesota, only about 13% of unemployed Minnesotans actually go into and seek the services of our Workforce Center. And the vast majority of businesses and employers do not seek the services of our Workforce Center. And so we believe while we improve the systems and the alignment and the product that we have available to job seekers and employers, we also have to increase the awareness. And so we're currently conducting research to inform a branding and marketing campaign that better creates a unified experience and increases the awareness that our customers have about our workforce system around the state. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think I would like to hand it over to my colleagues to talk in greater detail about how these services play out at the local level.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Ann Kilzer. I'm the director of the Minnesota Workforce Council Association. So just a little bit to put in context what we're talking about here. Jeremy talked a lot, or Deputy Commissioner Willis, Hanson-Willis talked a lot about the workforce centers themselves, but there's also a system in place behind the workforce centers that organizes how the services are run. So there's this map in your packets. So I think that's hopefully will be helpful along with the PowerPoint that I'm going to be walking through. There are 16 workforce service areas in Minnesota, and it's actually the local elected officials who, under our federal laws, determine what the service areas are. So as you can see, there are two that are independent cities, which are the City of Minneapolis and the City of Duluth, several independent counties, and then in Greater Minnesota in particular, it's consortiums of counties who are working together to deliver the services to our job seekers and employers. In each service area, there's a workforce council. The workforce council has to be made up of at least 50% private industry members. Those workforce councils also include representatives from labor, community-based organizations, education, economic development, and others, and they're responsible for overseeing the strategic services of the area. They also determine where the workforce centers are. So in conjunction with our partners in the state agency, determining where the workforce centers are located based on the needs of their region, as well as the availability of staff across the state. So members of the Workforce Council Association are partners in the Workforce Centers along with the state-run programs. And the folks that I work with are responsible for the youth, dislocated worker, and adult programs. The federal legislation, which I mentioned, has been around for over a decade and was an early implementer of the competitive approach in regard to the delivery of these three programs. As I mentioned, it's actually the workforce boards who determine who the service providers are in their local areas. In most cases, the providers of these services are not state agency employees, although in a few workforce centers they are. But often they're community-based organizations or county staff who are providing the services for adults, dislocated workers, and youth. That's why it's critical that we're working closely, like the Deputy Commissioner said, with our partners, because we're all providing services in the same buildings through different funding streams and different job seekers that we're serving. Our providers receive formula funding from federal resources for adult, youth, and dislocated worker services. Additionally, we are the recipients of state workforce development funds that are not otherwise allocated to outside entities by the legislature. So that's the workforce development fund that the legislature has oversight of. A major focus is to organize a continuing of these opportunities in a career pathway or pipeline, intentionally linking training to jobs that are available. So alignment is the key for the work of the workforce boards, coordinating workforce development programs, both with our state agency partners and others in the community, to serve job seekers and employers. So our association actually has representation from each of the 16 areas. It's a chief local elected official. So in the cases of the cities, it's the mayor. Otherwise, it's a county commissioner. The workforce board chair, and then the director of services for the adult dislocated worker and youth programs who make up our association. And again, we work very closely with the agencies and with the governor's workforce development council as well. So the deputy commissioner kind of went over several more statistics and indicated that I'd be talking a little bit more about what this looks like at the local level and the services that are provided. So I just pulled a couple examples from Greater Minnesota that I thought would be useful. And sort of the principles that our services are surrounded by, we want them to be demand-driven so that they're meeting the needs of employers in the communities, which why having employers make up 50% of our workforce boards is so important. Also having that employer involvement. Partnerships across silos so that we're aligning resources, state, federal, as well as community resources, and then meeting the needs of the community. So some really specific examples. One is from Stearns and Benton counties, working with Golden Plump, who anticipates 10% growth over the next several years. So the CEO, Mike Helgelson, who is a third-generation Golden Plump leader, has committed to developing their own workforce, acknowledging that many of their workers are immigrant and refugee communities that possess limited English proficiency. So the Stearns Benton Employment and Training Council developed, in partnership with Golden Plump and partners in adult basic education, integrated English language learning classes, meaning employees are learning language skills relevant to their work. So students were paid to attend class, which was held in the morning, so the night shift and day shift employees could participate. Golden Plump Human Service Resource Staff acted as the liaison between students and supervisors, who provided critical input, scheduling, and work application opportunities. And then Stearns Benton has also worked with Golden Plump to facilitate credit-based manufacturing classes for incumbent workers on-site at the Cold Spring facility. Funding sources for this particular project include federal funds, state competitive grants authorized by those of you who have served on this committee in the past. Adult basic education funding is also utilized, as well as other community resources. Golden Plump provided tuition reimbursement, lab space, and a lot of support from the leadership, particularly in their human resources department. So that's an example of incumbent worker training, where we're working with an employer who's training their own workforce. Also important is experiential learning, or learning while you're earning. A positive trend is that many companies are interested in onshoring the manufacture of their products.
Representative Mahoney has a question.
Yes.
And I'm going to use Golden Plump as an example, but only because you brought them up. So on your incumbent credit-based incumbent worker training, do you track how much they were making coming into that training and how much they were making as a salary when they left that training?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we do. Earned income is one of the measures that we track, both in our federal resources as well as state resources, as a result of our programs, as well as some of the measurements that were put in place several years ago by the legislature. So that is one of the things that we track for all of our programs.
So one other question.
Representative Mahoney.
Can you give me an idea of, or give the committee an idea of, those coming into the program, what they were making, and once they were done with the training, what they were making, just off the top of your head, or do you have that with you?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, unfortunately I don't for this particular example, but we certainly could get you for all of our programs and to the committee as well what those numbers are. If you're interested in this particular example, we can get that as well.
Just in general, that'd be great. Share it with the committee. That'd be good to know.
Absolutely.
Because if we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars as a state, both public and private, it'd be nice to know that they're making more than 50 cents more an hour or $5 more an hour. Sometimes you get, you know, got to be penny wise and pound foolish.
Good idea.
I'll follow up on that. So, Mr. Chair, another example, as I was mentioning, is experiential learning, where folks are actually learning while they're earning money as well. In Lou Rich in southeast Minnesota, opportunities for growth were limited by the number of technical and skilled labor employees in the area, an issue, as the deputy commissioner mentioned, that we see often. Furthermore, a large portion of the employees in this particular company have worked for the company for over 20 years and are looking at retiring within the next 5 to 10 years. So the Albert Lee High School agreed to partner with the company and identified juniors and seniors who had interest and ability in the industrial sector, who were provided an opportunity for apprenticeships at Lou Rich that qualify for credit as approved by the Minnesota Department of Education while gaining real-world work experience. Resources for mentor training, mentoring, student recruitment, and coordination of the project was provided by Workforce Development, Inc., the workforce partner in this case. WDI also screens the potential students by providing career assessments, counseling, and determines if students are eligible for other programming, so it reaches beyond this particular partnership for those services. In regard to sector strategies, again, we try to be very demand-driven in addressing employer needs or a group of employer needs in the case of sector strategies. So Minnesota has the Fast Track Initiative, which is a streamlined career pathway system where low-skilled job seekers can earn credentials on an accelerated timeline through integrated learning opportunities. The statewide competitive grant initiative was started with the Joyce Foundation Resources, which is an independent entity that serves all of the Great Lakes region, but has since been funded by federal resources and state resources, including a dedicated legislative appropriation. The purpose of this particular project in South Central Minnesota is to increase the basic skill level of students while concurrently providing nursing skill training. The curriculum includes contextualized instruction in workplace reading, writing, speaking, and math. Integrated classes include nursing assistant and medical terminology. Work readiness skills are also addressed. In this particular example, partners included employers in the healthcare industry, so Elder Care of Minnesota, Parker Oaks, Minnesota Valley Healthcare Center, Mapleton Community Home, and several more. This is an example of where several employers in an industry with common needs are partnering with the public sector to describe what skills and training is necessary to be employed within their industry. This career pathway results in credentials in certified nursing assistant and home health aide. There are several other examples of fast track programs across the state focusing on manufacturing, IT, and other in-demand sectors with common needs. My final example of things that are happening across the state is youth career counseling. This initiative, along with three others, received pilot funding from a grant from the legislature in the last biennium. In 2010 and 2011, Minnesota ranked third from the bottom in the ratio of counselors to students, and it hasn't gotten better since then, as many of you know. In 2013, the world's best workforce legislation was passed at the state level, mandating districts to assist all students by no later than ninth grade to explore their college and career interests and aspirations and to develop a plan for a smooth and successful transition to post-secondary education or employment. And we really found that the Workforce Center was well poised to assist in this mandate and that the two public systems can be working together to maximize the resources that go into these activities. In this particular example in northeast Minnesota, the overall messaging to students was not everyone needs a four-year degree, but everyone needs some kind of training after high school. And the workforce centers are particularly successful in delivering this message because they have the partnerships with local colleges. Workforce center staff are on site on many campuses. Staff has developed understanding of apprenticeship opportunities through major trade organizations who also sit on the workforce boards. Workforce centers can provide resources to encourage those that want to go to college but think they can't afford it by helping with FAFSA applications and other resources. We also provide assessments that are already available at the workforce centers to students in schools. And in this pilot site, e-mentoring partnership has been engaging business community with actually emailing students who might be interested in a particular industry and creating a mentorship opportunities for them. They partnered with the Northland Foundation to develop a career exploration pathway to careers conference. This conference hosted 1,100 students from 22 schools, had 65 interactive booths. 99% rated the conference as excellent or good. I think getting 99% of teenagers to rate anything excellent or good is difficult to do, so we're pleased with that outcome. And many employers are looking for ways to interact with the students, so they've been the catalyst for helping form these relationships with teachers as well. The four pilot programs funded by the legislature all have outstanding results, and we're hopeful that that initiative can be taken statewide and that we'll be able to find the resources to do so. My final example is co-location. So again, the workforce boards and the local elected officials are responsible for determining where the workforce centers are located. And sometimes if employers don't come to you, you go to them. I mentioned that in Little Falls, Crestliner was abandoning their facility, and an entrepreneur in the area with previous experience in creating incubator facilities viewed this as the perfect place to create the Little Falls Manufacturing Development Center. At the same time, Rural Minnesota SEP, our workforce provider, was looking for new space for the workforce center in the area. So currently, the Little Falls Manufacturing Center is home to 15 businesses, the Workforce Center, and the Tri-County Community Action Center. Workforce Center clients have successfully landed jobs with the companies housed within the same building. Job counselors and workforce staff know exactly what those 15 businesses are looking for, and the services are specifically geared toward meeting the needs of those employers to the extent possible. So those are the examples that I have of things, initiatives that are happening in Greater Minnesota that address various needs that the Deputy Commissioner outlined when it comes to our workforce. Some of the challenges that we have, of course, the sustainable funding is a challenge. A lot of the resources that we have are competitive grants that are for shorter term and not necessarily providing support for the system to maximize as a whole when it's just for one-time grant opportunities. Flexibility in funding. One provisioner in the governor's budget that was released last week would allow local areas to use the state dislocated worker dollars for more incumbent worker training. And once the demands of dislocated workers are met, we see that kind of flexibility is very key to providing services so that our local workforce boards can meet the demands of the employers and job seekers in their region. Employer engagement is very important, but many employers, particularly small businesses, don't have the time or the knowledge to engage with the system or can even articulate what their workforce needs might be 6 months from now. But yet their input is critical, so we are very interested in making processes as easy as possible for employers so that they can access services. And finally, many of our programs are geared towards specific populations, which is important, but some greater flexibility to serve individuals reaching down or beyond existing pathways to address the needs of different populations, many of which are mentioned, including those with disabilities, long-term unemployed, youth, English language learners, or those who have other skills to employment, who are most likely to be left behind as the economy recovers. So that's kind of a quick picture of what's happening at the local level. I think, Connie, with the Governor's Workforce Development Council.
We have three questions right now.
Sure, I'm happy to take questions.
Representative Norton's first, Representative Keel's second, and Representative Moran's third.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have two questions, and they're really related. So here at the legislature, and I appreciate your presentation. Mm-hmm. Thank you. We've talked earlier, and
yes. You
guys really do some nice work. But here at the legislature, we're approached by people with great ideas, and they're here because there's either a perception that there's nothing out there to help them, or they've identified a need that they don't feel is being addressed. And so as I was listening to the first testifier and the percent of people that actually use the services, it's quite low. And so how are we to know here at the legislature whether we should create a new program or direct you to do something different? And it really gets to the question and how you were talking about it there at the end, is you do need to do some changes, change with the times. But how can we help you address this? And let's stop with that, and then I'll go to the second part because it is related.
Whoever would.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll attempt to answer the question, and perhaps Ann will want to add as well. It's a very good question. Part of what I think we need to understand is that there's a combination of many different types of funding that support different parts of the system. If I were to generalize just a moment, generally the federal funds that we receive through the Workforce Investment Act provide the bulk of the funding for the workforce centers around the state and a more universal customer set of services so that any unemployed Minnesotan or any Minnesotan who wants to advance their career can walk into a workforce center and receive services. The state funds, primarily through the Workforce Development Fund, we use and think that the great advantage of those funds is allowing us a greater ability to focus on these populations that have barriers to employment. So some of the populations that we've referenced that have higher levels of unemployment, these state programs, Fast Track, for example, or the Adult Competitive or the youth-funded programs, allow us much greater flexibility to be able to focus on these populations who are at greater risk of not getting work and higher unemployment as a result. And so we find that the greatest benefit of the state programs are allowing us to have the flexibility and nimbleness to be able to focus on these populations who have greater need, of which the federal funding does not allow us as much of an opportunity to do so. So I would think that would be one measure of importance of the programs that allow us to focus on those populations at risk, and also make sure that we're delivering on the results and the outcomes for exactly those populations.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I think I would just add that at the local level, having some funding that's a little bit more flexible so that we can respond to employer needs quickly. You know, the competitive grants do allow a lot of the things that the Deputy Commissioner was referring to, and they're very, very helpful to the public workforce system. But a lot of times employers will come to us who don't have the time or the resources to go through a competitive grant process that happens once a year, or things like that. So something, some resources at the local level perhaps, where people are working within the communities and have those personal relationships that we can respond more quickly, would also be beneficial.
And Mr. Chair, your competitive grant comment leads me to the second part, which is, since I've been up here at the Capitol, I've done workforce development in one committee or another since I've been up here and tried to learn from Representative Mahoney, although he may say I haven't learned a thing. But, you know, we get folks come here and ask for grants to help with a particular, he's nodding his head, particular project. And we've tried really hard, at least I have since I've been here, and I know others, to find an accountability component. How can we make certain that the grants have a good return on investment and we're not just doing a bunch of projects that aren't supportive? And we've asked the department to do that. But again, we get people that come to the Capitol with the best of intentions, who have a great idea, who want us to fund them outside of the ROI and accountability venue. And when that happens, I hear from my workforce development saying, we do this, or we can do it. And one glitch that I've heard is that while some of these workforce development centers offer grants, not all of them do. And so then there is a hole in one or two areas where they can't get a grant. And so then they come here and ask us to fund it separately. And so, you know, we've just had this constant tension about how do we keep the programs, you know, in the Workforce Development Center venue and under the Office of Economic Development's review, so we can make sure we are getting a good return on investment, and we hope they'll tell us if they're not. But again, when not all the groups do grants, we are going to continue to have the ask here. So is there a way, even though these are all different independent centers, that we could have an effort made to make certain that they all do some of the same sorts of things, so we don't have the holes and we don't get individual requests?
Mr. Chair, members, I think the short answer is yes. One of the opportunities available to us right now is that last summer the President and Congress signed into law new legislation which governs much of this system at the federal level and here in Minnesota. The Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, or WIOA, replaces the Workforce Investment Act, or WIA. And one of the opportunities of that law is it does have, even though this is very much a localized system with a lot of local control around the state, it does give the state and the State Workforce Council increased authority to establish expectations and performance that are statewide. So regardless of how you might draw regional or local maps around the state, or how initiatives get localized, because you're correct that some workforce center areas do a lot of sub-granting and others don't. But at the end of the day, we have some authority today, and we believe greater authority under the new legislation to be able to work with our local areas, but to establish statewide performance metrics. Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, while I have the floor, there was one other aspect to your comment that I just must answer as well, because I think it's one of the difficult aspects of doing this work and doing any kind of public sector work, about public awareness of the services that we provide. And we have a lot of evidence that the public services and the job seekers and the employers who use our workforce centers leave with a very positive experience and get much value from that. And so while we can constantly improve those services, we have a lot of evidence and anecdote to think that people are getting the services that they need. The question is, are they aware of it to begin with? And one of the more challenging things to fund in the public sector is marketing, branding, advertising. Those are the sort of things that are difficult to find dollars for. But if you have a good product, at some point you have to make sure that your customers, public and job seekers, know that those services are available, which is one of the reasons why we're focusing on that in our strategy going forward. And part of that effort will be to identify funds to make sure that more people are aware of these good programs.
Okay. Next we have Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Director Kilzer?
Kilzer.
Wanted to make sure I got it right. Just a FYI, this is kind of a housekeeping thing. When I look at this map, mm-hmm. I'm curious as to if you know where WSA 1 is in Northwest Corner. What your address says Thief River Falls.
Mm-hmm.
However, Thief River Falls is in Pennington County, not Marshall. So it probably makes no difference to most people, except for up in my corner of the world, that would be a big difference. And just FYI, I believe Detroit Lakes is in Becker County, not Hubbard. So I know it's kind of minor, but
Mr. Chair and members, if I may, so the box that indicates is referring to the entire workforce service okay. area, not to a specific workforce center.
Good
so
to
the
know.
Workforce centers are the addresses that you're seeing on the back, in addition to others within those service areas. But the indication on the map is just to the area as a whole, and not to the specific address that's listed on the flip side of the paper. Sorry for any confusion.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Good to know. Because sometimes it looks central when it's not, or mm-hmm. it is central when it doesn't look it. So anyway, Mr. Chair, can I ask another question?
Certainly.
So of all the programs that you're working on with workforce housing, what do you see as most successful? I'm looking for workforce training.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Chair.
We both may have a different.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Chair and members, and I think an opportunity for Connie Ireland from the Governor's Workforce Development Council, who kind of their charge is looking over the state systems and identifying promising practices and the like. I think any time where employers are highly involved in the process from the beginning are the most successful programs, whether we're working with incumbent workers or youth or dislocated workers. It's that piece where we're really targeting our services to what employers need and where job opportunities are that our job seekers are most successful. So that's, I would say, the critical component across all of the programs. As far as our outcomes with specific populations, we're meeting or exceeding our performance measures in all of those, so it's hard to identify one versus the other. But I think it's the components that go into the successful programs that's probably the more important piece.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, there are many examples which we could choose from, but I think I would take the opportunity to highlight our Fast Track program and the representative that is of career pathways in general. And as we may hopefully have another opportunity to come to this committee to talk about the proposal that was in Governor Dayton's budget about a new career pathways program, reorganizing existing resources. But there's a lot of evidence in Minnesota with Fast Track and around the country that career pathways is really the very successful model and the model of the future. And one of the essential aspects of a career pathway system is that it brings together many of these partners to work together in a more seamless way for employ or job seekers who have barriers to employment. So it's specifically looking at low income, lower skill, low educated folks who make up a great share of what's left in our unemployed population. And it gives them not only a training and a credential that we know there's demand in the industry and employers waiting for them at the end of the line, but it also recognizes the reality of where they are today. And so it's not just a workforce center, it's probably also a community-based supportive services provider. It's adult basic education and a Minsky campus and an employer all working together to have a plan for that person to figure out what they need, not just to get their credential and their education, but if they need transportation or health care or English as a second language or all these other supportive services that many of our folks who are still unemployed today need. And that kind of individualized, albeit more time-intensive and labor-intensive, really seems to be the one that is effective, which is why Fast Track has not only been celebrated in Minnesota, but around the country. It's been noted by the White House as a successful workforce development program nationwide, which is why the governor has a proposal to expand on that model through a new Career Pathways program. And if you would like more information or more specific statistics about Fast Track, we'd be glad to share that with the entire committee.
May I ask another question? So, I don't know if we have time for this, but how do you measure the success of those programs when you're putting that together?
Quickly,
sure. Mr. Chair, members, employment, wages, and a credential that has demand in the marketplace.
Okay. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, first, I just want to say thank you for your presentation that you presented here. And I know this is a committee that is focusing on greater Minnesota economics and workforce development, but I would be really remiss if I sat here and only focused on that and not look at, you know, some of the great disparities in communities of color and African-American community, and looking at the high number of unemployment in the African-American community. And, you know, I see a lot of great partnerships here, a lot of initiative that's going on in greater Minnesota that is creating some opportunity for more engagement in the workforce and training and development. But they don't always see that in communities of color. And so, you know, can you maybe off the top of your head, because it's not planned, just talk about ways that you're doing some outreach to capture those communities?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are many examples of this as well. And as I think, and I hope we were making clear in our presentation that populations with barriers to employment, especially populations of color, are a very high priority for us. And as we look at all of our programs, especially the state programs that we have greater flexibility, but also the federal programs, this is a high priority. And I think when you look at Fast Track, where the majority of people served in that statewide program are people of color, when you look at the people who go into workforce centers around the state, 70% of them are people of color. When you look at our youth programs, both the Minnesota Youth Program in particular, which I believe has about 60% of the young people served are youth of color. And so some of our key programs are serving many people of color around the state. And so I think that we are attempting to use the resources that are available to us to meet that need. And we can provide that direction in the grant proposals themselves, but it's ultimately up to the local areas around the state. But I see lots of examples where that is being used. And for example, in Minneapolis, where the very well-known Step Up program, which is primarily funded through a combination of state and federal dollars that I've just mentioned, 95% of the kids in Step Up are kids of color, 98% are low income, more than 90% have experience of either an immigrant or are in class with immigrants. And so I think the programs that we are available are trying to meet that need to the greatest extent that we can.
Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Moran.
So yes, Fast Track and these other initiatives do focus on youth. You know, a lot of times those are summer jobs, they're not permanent jobs. It doesn't create opportunity for advancement and things like that, you know, livable wage jobs. And so as I look at the workforce development, and a couple of things that I think I heard you talk about is that you have what you call, gosh, where is it, continuous of service in people's lives, you know. It's right here. But you seem to have partnerships with, you're trying to find how to engage those that you're already engaged with, you know. And it seems like so some of your program is directed towards that that path. And I would say that often enough, when we look at our state government, Representative Norton talks about, you know, a lot of times people feel as though they're not getting the support and the access to opportunities. Those opportunities are not reaching their community, so they come to us with something innovative, something that has been done before. And we look at those entities where we have funded in the past to continue to do what we do with the relationships that we already have, and that we're not open enough to be creative and innovative to believe that sometimes those community knows what's best for that community, or how to engage people in a dynamic workforce because they are a part of that community. And so oftentimes those type of opportunities are missed here, and we don't fund those things for many different reasons. And so can you, what is the barrier to those type of opportunities in your mind or experience?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the question. And one of the things that is a very exciting initiative we're working on right now is helping the development and creation of what's called the Emerging Workforce Coalition. The Emerging Workforce Coalition is a new informal entity of community-based organizations serving communities of color primarily in the metro area. And they're some of the organizations that you might have heard about because they play very large roles in communities of color, including Summit Academy OIC, the Urban League, CLUES, Latino Economic Development Center, and others. Organizations that work with and represent communities of color have come to Deed, actually, and said, help us to partner with you to better understand and identify best practices to reach out into communities of color around the state to find out two things. First of all, what are the assets of these community of color organizations that they might have to offer to the workforce system to improve our programs and services? What best practices and assets can we learn from them that we might not know about? And also to give us input on how some of our programs can be improved. Even though I think we're doing a pretty good job to reach populations of color, we can continue to do so in a greater way. And the last important thing about this coalition is that even though they're focused in Minneapolis, they're reaching statewide, and they are holding outreach, and we're helping to fund them to do outreach all around the state to engage a community of color organizations throughout Minnesota, because we know our entire state is diversifying, not just in the metro area. And so I think some of the barriers, and part of the reason that we're funding this coalition, is to produce a report to help identify exactly what they think the barriers are to them being more involved in the workforce center system. Some of the early ideas are simply, again, lack of awareness, that many communities of color and the organizations who represent them have not sought or successfully sought and achieved funding through state programs because they don't know them or they don't know how to access them. So I think through this effort, we'll be able to identify more of these barriers and being able to address them more directly.
So one more question, Mr. Chair.
A whole people want to talk about housing, and we have three more people want to ask questions about this.
I have a quick statement.
Thank you.
I would just like to say, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to really engage, to really find a way that you can engage communities of color in a better way, because what we do know is that relationships are important. And the only relationship that we have from administration to administration are the same relationships. We don't know what else is out there. And so that piece is really, really important. So I just want to thank you for going beyond the usual, business as usual, to engage communities of color in conversation about outreach. Because one thing that I do know is that communities of color want to take care of themselves and their family, you know, and the best way to do that is to have a job and be able to do that. So, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I don't mean to belabor the point, but if I may, just...
You're taking Connie's time.
It'll be 30 seconds of comments. I just wanted to state too that I had mentioned that the workforce boards are responsible for kind of the strategic service delivery and really engaging employers. So it's one thing to be training folks, but the other thing is the employment hiring practices
yes.
as well. So our Ramsey County Workforce Board with the City of Minneapolis Workforce Board has engaged in an Everybody In initiative, mm-hmm. and they're actually working with their employers on their workforce boards to do some peer-to-peer discussions about hiring practices and disparities in hiring. And those findings and some of the strategies are being replicated with our other workforce boards in the metro area as well as in greater Minnesota that have higher populations of minorities as well. So we're looking at it not only from the service delivery side, but from the employer side as well.
That's great.
Very well, we have Mahoney, Lean, and Miller next. Mahoney, you're first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question for the testifier and then a question for yourself. On the workforce centers, how are they funded? Are they funded as a lump sum federal, or are they funded on individuals served? So do you get like a dollar for everybody you serve, or is it you get $100,000 every year?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, the way the workforce centers themselves are funded is that we take all the programs that get both state and federal funding, and a percentage of each of the programs goes towards administrative costs. So it's a partnership between the state agency programs as well as the local programs to fund the actual centers and the resource rooms that are kind of the common space that anybody can utilize. So it's a combination of state and federal funds, partnerships at the local level.
Mr. Chair, last year we put substantial money into, for lack of a better word, an accountability issue. And I don't know, when you have DEED come forward to do their budget or their presentation, it would be good to have, to give them a heads up that it would be delightful to hear where they started, what they've done, and where they are today, and where they're planning on going tomorrow.
You and I are thinking exactly the same way.
Because frankly, depending on who's lobbying for which particular program, sometimes we've had an awful lot of money going to some places that didn't quite make much sense.
Looking forward to that. Thank you. Next we have Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in light of Representative Mahoney's comments, my question may be answered in future testimony. But to Deputy Commissioner Hanson-Willis and Director Kills, you commented a little bit on what some of the accountability measures are, employment attainment, wages and things. Can you just comment on how those are developed, you know, how that criteria is established?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and members, through a lot of conversation and resources, that is a brief answer to your question. There are many, many performance measures that are part of our system, both the federal dollars and the state dollars. And there is no one performance metric, or not even one set of metrics. We have the state legislated report card, which is available on our website, which has a series of performance outcomes of these programs. In order for us to continue receiving federal funding through WIA and WIOA, they're very clear, I mean, inches thick performance reports that we need to provide in terms of the people who enter a workforce center. Do they actually end up in employment? What's the experience of that customer in the process of going into employment? So some of these performance metrics are made very clear and mandated to us by the federal government or by the state legislature. In addition, and perhaps Director Ireland can talk about this as well, one of the recent projects of the Governor's Workforce Council is to look at net impact and return on investment of our programs as well. And so there are certain programs that really fit well into that category when you can look at the amount invested versus the amount return and the economic impact of increased wages of Minnesotans on the broader economy in the state. So those are a number of different measures, and I think we look at the ultimate outcome, which is employment for folks and meeting the needs of our employers, but also the impact in terms of ROI that wages has on the broader economic situation of the state and the use of state and federal dollars. So, in a nutshell.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and actually my not to belabor the point, but I think my question may fall in line with all of the previous ones, so perhaps a future hearing would be good on this, because when we talk about some of the things that you're doing, I hear words that are like, yeah, that's right, you know, yeah, I know exactly where you're going, then all of a sudden I go, well, wait a second, I don't know exactly what you're talking about. So this is one of those. So I want to make sure we know what we're doing. So I heard the word barrier a bunch of times, and perhaps I missed it. But what is Deed's, I don't know, look at this two ways. What is Deed's definition of barrier? Or what are some examples? Because I hear, well, we have these barriers. Well, what is a barrier? I'm just curious to know. Maybe I missed it, but if you could explain it to me, that would be great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, appreciate the question and the opportunity to respond. The first situation that we look at is the unemployment. It gives us an indication of who exactly is being affected here. And when we look at the overall unemployment, as we mentioned, among certain populations, there's higher degrees of unemployment. And so we know that there are, therefore, reasons for that. It's not just by accident. And I think that there are both supply side, what I would call supply side, and demand side barriers to employment. Certainly for the folks who are still unemployed, there are reasons for that. And it may mean that they have a criminal history, or they have intermittent work history, or they have childcare or transportation needs, or they've experienced racism or discrimination. Many things in their world that makes it more difficult for them to find employment. Or people with disabilities, for example, I could use the same set of examples. On the other hand, and I think those are very real barriers that make it more difficult for people to find employment. On the demand side, I think there are things that some employers do which also erect barriers. And there are great examples of employers who do a lot of outreach, who go above and beyond to accommodate people with disabilities in the workplace, to reach out to communities of color and to immigrant communities. But many businesses do not. And they have not analyzed their hiring practices. They can unnecessarily weed out people just because they've been unemployed for more than a year or who have a gap in their resume. And sometimes, especially in large companies, those are very automated systems. And resumes come in, and if there's a gap in the employment history, the resume just goes out the window. And some companies, I think the largest and most recognizable is U.S. Bank, that have attempted to address these very real barriers to say, how do we make sure that we're not kicking people out of our hiring process unnecessarily? And so I think there's a role both for business and for individual job seekers to address some of those challenges. And so I think at the heart of it, when we say barriers to employment, we literally mean reasons that make it more difficult for someone to find employment at a time when our economy demands it.
And just one real quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. If I understand this process then properly, you are basically conforming some of these programs with the regionals or whatever to address whatever barriers are at least present within that zone. That's kind of what you're saying. Okay, thank you.
Next, we have about 5 minutes, so if you could quickly describe what you do, we would appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you for being here, and in lieu of time, I'll be as brief as possible. I'm Connie Ireland, the Executive Director from the Governor's Workforce Development Council. So if I could provide a very short overview of what the Governor's Workforce Development Council does and who we are, I'd be greatly appreciative for that. The Governor's Workforce Development Council was actually created under the Workforce Investment Act of 1998. Currently, we have 31 voting members and 4 non-voting members, all of which are appointed by the governor. We are not a majority private sector board at this point in time, but of the 6 private sector members, we have 5 of them that serve on local workforce boards across the state. We have geographic distribution by representation on the board as well. The role of the Governor's Workforce Development Council is really to develop policy recommendations and oversees Minnesota's workforce development system, really to meet to ensure that businesses have the workforce and the skills of skilled employees to meet their needs or business needs. The role of the GWC really brings together workforce development stakeholders to really discuss and identify opportunities for new initiatives, really disseminate best practices, much of what you heard about today earlier, develop strategic goals to meet some of the specific needs, and really to address how we might better align or leverage resources in the state as well. So really that overall vehicle by which the local boards can actually come together to share, and we have that heightened awareness then to deliver and disseminate those best practices. The GWDC last year underwent a couple of visioning sessions to really identify where our goals and our resources and what can we be and how can we best serve the state of Minnesota. During that process, we really identified a couple key priorities, and this was pre the announcement of the new federal legislation. But during that time, there were two really key buckets that were identified. One was really how can we address the disparities gap in Minnesota? And secondly, the work that has been done in career pathways across the state. Minnesota is recognized as a national leader in this area. And the council itself felt those were really two key priorities to really engage in. So along that same process, we had the passing of the new federal legislation, the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and under the new WIOA law, as you heard before, this is an opportunity to really somewhat wipe the slate clean, move forward, and create a better opportunity for a development of local and regional and statewide plans that we can collectively work together. It's not a plan that's going to go on a shelf. But we can work the plan, we can identify performance common outcomes, performance outcomes, and really have a greater impact overall for Minnesota's workforce system as a whole. So in addition, the board decided that we really needed to, in partnership, in collaboration with MWCA and with DEED, do a better job of meeting those goals. In addition, Minnesota has always identified businesses as one of the dual customers. This has also been an increased awareness under the WIOA law, but again, to ensure that we're meeting the needs of businesses in a meaningful way to develop the talent and the skills of their employees of the future. Just briefly, I provided a few population demographics for you. We've talked a great deal about population, and again, just to emphasize that Greater Minnesota as a whole has an aging population. And we also have if you look at the comparison between Greater Minnesota and the Twin Cities metro area, it's almost split. So what it's telling all of us is we need everybody employed in Greater Minnesota that can be employed. We need to grow our minority population so we can meet the needs of our workforce for our businesses. And we need to look at best solutions and best recommendations and other best practices across the state in Greater Minnesota that we can be effective and efficient in meeting those needs of businesses. So Minnesota's workforce, we talked a little bit before about the youth unemployment rate. It is somewhat frightening, the youth unemployment rate and how high it is, which also tells us that the opportunity for experiential learning for many of those youth is non-existent. Some of the work that we have done in the past, and I'll point out two reports that were recently released as well, that the opportunity for experiential learning for youth is critical, it's meaningful. We address that in our building partnerships to overcome barriers publication, which all of you should have a copy of in your packets. And so please refer to that too, specifically with some of the youth initiatives. But I will point out that in Minnesota, we do serve 5 times the national average for American Indian youth, and we do serve 2.5 times the national average for American Asian American youth. So Minnesota is really meeting that objective. We are addressing the disparities gap, in particular with youth, but we need to reach out to businesses in a much more meaningful way to provide opportunities for all of these youth. So with that, I'm here today then also to talk about the recent report that was released to all of you. It is the Workforce Center Report, Minnesota on the Move, the World's Best Workforce. This is a statutory requirement every odd year. The Governor's Workforce Development Council produces this report to all of you. The report is approved by our executive committee, and the report really includes recommendations regarding workforce centers, the workforce center system, programs, funding, and administrative changes. In the report that you do have, there are 4 sections. The first section really addresses a brief history of Minnesota's workforce center system, which according to any findings that I could find, It had been since about 1996, since a report was really delivered on the workforce center system in the state. The second section really addresses the performance and programs that many of you asked about. And you will find in that section just a brief snippet of primarily the Workforce Investment Act performance requirements and outcomes. I'm really happy to say that Minnesota does meet the performance requirements and exceeds in most cases. So we are doing a good job, but we can't sit back and rest on our laurels and feel that what we do today is going to meet the needs of individuals tomorrow. The third section outlines the opportunities, again, the innovation and the opportunity piece under WIOA and what that means for Minnesota as a whole. We're in a transition period, and I will say it's an opportunity period, not just transition. And lastly, Deputy Commissioner spoke in depth about the strategic service delivery project that is underway to really address how we must think about doing delivering services and how we must think differently in the future to really meet that broader need of all individuals, for youth, for persons of color, our business community as a whole. So we can change that 13% to a much higher number and also identify how virtual services can have an impact there as well. And the question when we talked about before about what are barriers to employment, it's clearly stated under Minnesota Workforce Centers, their primary focus is on five barriers that they name. So racial disparities, long-term unemployment, youth unemployment, and again, it's the access to professional and social networks, and then placement into family-sustaining wages. So those really key areas. And then lastly are the recommendations that really complement the goals of the Strategic Service Delivery Project. I won't read those for you. I would rather just point out that the other reports, you have the full report for you. And the other report is the 2014 policy recommendations over building partnerships to overcome barriers, which addresses the importance of experiential learning opportunities and career pathways in Minnesota. And then much of the discussion that was really centered in this would be another whole hearing report that's really focused on smart investments, real results. It's the net impact pilot study that the GWDC conducted over a period of 5 years. And it's just a snippet of bringing together a collection of data and data sharing agreements across several different state agencies, which was an enormous undertaking in itself, but really proving that this methodology can really deliver looking at a net impact for some of the pilot programs. And to be very specific, the career pathways work that we have entered into, we are looking at opportunities and measurements and metrics that we can collectively look at those impacts moving forward as well too. So as a pilot, we can move from the pilot phase into our next phase, which is really full implementation. So with that, I will leave it open for any questions.
Well, I'd just like to say one thing. You all three exemplify the excitement that you live in. I'm really, the Deputy Commissioner, I think you can talk for 3 hours without stopping. and it's a good thing. And I've known Connie for a long time. And Anne, you really believe in what you do, and I appreciate it very much. And I'm sorry we have to hurry up into workforce housing. And with that, we're going to try to have two people up at the same time. And we're going to give about 4 minutes per person. I'm sorry we don't have more time. We will schedule differently. No, thank you. I appreciate all you do. So first we have Dan Dorman and Warren Hansen up there. I would love to have you come and give us a 4 minute of what you are doing and want to do.
I know what I'm doing?
I know what you're
doing. That's a whole different story.
Legitimately.
I thought we just jocularity.
Jump right in there, buddy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dan Dorman. I'm the executive director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. The partnership, for those of you who are unfamiliar with us, I apologize that you are, because you shouldn't be. That means I'm not doing my job. But for those familiar with the partnership, we do economic development advocacy on behalf of Greater Minnesota. We have over 90 members of the partnership, from private businesses, nonprofits, economic development agencies, chambers of commerce, and some of our MinSCU partners are also joining us. And so, Mr. Chair and members, as we get around the state and talk to job creators, I'm sure most of you have. There are several issues that seem to come up no matter what part of the state you're in, and always within the top three is the issue of workforce housing. And you can pick the corner of the state, small town, big town, medium town, the issue's still there. And from our perspective, it seems to be a market failure. The market's not responding to the need, and we think it's important for the state to stimulate that market in a way that will create more workforce housing. And I would even argue that it's not a job a creator, it's a job filler. We're talking about, in many cases, jobs that are there and available if people could find a place to live. And so we think it's important to cure this. We've got a couple of suggestions. And to my left, Mr. Chair, is our policy analyst, Mr. Chris Hengem. And with your permission, he'll walk you through kind of the concept of an idea that we're just getting the jackets back on. So we haven't dropped the bill yet, Mr. Chair. But Mr. Hengem would walk you through that if it's okay with you.
Mr. Hengem, give your name for the record and continue.
Hi, Mr. Chair. This is Chris Hengem, analyst for the Greater Minnesota Partnership. I will go through this pretty quickly, but it's a little different than the DEED pilot program for workforce housing that you may have heard of, or some other DEED-related programs that give grants toward workforce housing. Our proposal is modeled after two programs. A program in North Dakota that provides a tax credit for investment into a state fund. The state fund we propose should be operated by DEED in a new Office of Workforce Housing. That state fund will provide grants, and those local investors, these are local investors into this fund, will get a tax credit for their investment into the fund to fund workforce housing. As a second piece of our proposal, we propose to give a 30% tax credit for investment into a particular project. So this might be an Arctic-Cat or Polaris or an Anderson Windows. So they would get a 30% tax credit on their investment. Apart from that, as I mentioned, we propose to create a new Office of Workforce Housing in DEED. We think that is necessary to align the mission of workforce housing, which is to create jobs and to grow communities. Right now, there are communities out there that have many, many job vacancies, and they just can't fill them. And they want to grow, and they can grow. They just don't have the housing for their workers. So we think that DEED is the appropriate place to put this program. And I guess I would toss it back to Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'd be happy to stand for any questions that you or members of the committee may have.
We'll answer questions at the end of the testifier so they all get a chance to testify. Please stand by.
Okay.
Next we have Warren Hansen. Doesn't look like Warren, but we'll take her anyway.
Warren Hansen's not actually here today.
We'd love to have you.
I'm after him.
Okay, that's even better.
Cross that one off your list.
We got that.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Rebecca Mullane, and I'm a program manager for CSH, where our mission is to advance solutions that use housing as a platform for services to improve the lives of the most vulnerable people, maximize public resources, and build healthy communities. To meet our mission, we facilitate the creation of supportive housing across the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to testify on behalf of Homes for All. You should have received a copy of our agenda today. It looks like this, and I'm going to walk you through it. 151 organizations from across the state have come together to create this agenda that includes strategic investments and successful programs that will improve the lives of all Minnesotans. I want to start my testimony today with finishing the overview of Minnesota Housing's testimony that Commissioner Tangerthal started last week. What the commissioner didn't get to in her presentation is that the area of our state with the greatest share of people experiencing homelessness is in Greater Minnesota. The state's highest rate of homelessness is in the Northwest region, which doesn't include any major urban centers. These counties include Beltrami, Hubbard, Marshall, Polk, Red Lake, and Roseau. The regional centers are places like Bemidji and Crookston and Thief River Falls. As I walk you through the Homes for All agenda, you will see several pieces that are aimed at ending homelessness for all Minnesotans, no matter where they live. We at CSH, along with our partners in Homes for All, know that quality housing is the foundation for all communities across Minnesota to reach their full potential. Each community needs the full continuum of housing to ensure individuals' and families' needs are met. This continuum consists of supportive housing for the most vulnerable among us, affordable housing, workforce housing, rental housing, and home ownership. A good example of the full continuum in practice would allow an individual who is experiencing homelessness in Greater Minnesota to become stabilized in a supportive housing unit. While they're in that supportive housing unit, they can start working at a part-time job for minimum wage, earn a degree, and get a full-time job that will move them into workforce housing. Well, in that workforce housing, they'll stay there until their wages increase and they can finally move into affordable housing. And hopefully, finally, if they want to, they can move into single home ownership. The Homes for All agenda supports to work all of these housing options on this continuum while being mindful of limited resources. If you take a closer look at your agenda, you'll notice there's a request for $8 million to the Housing Trust Fund. The Housing Trust Fund funds, among other things, a program for highly mobile youth. The most recent Wilder Research Homeless Survey found that Minnesota has 10,214 people experiencing homelessness. Of those, 46% are under the age of 21. These are young Minnesotans just starting out in their lives, not yet entered the workforce. It is imperative that we create a path for these children to future success instead of preordaining them to continue the cycle of homelessness. With the additional funding asked for, the Housing Trust Fund can support huge support programs like the Highly Mobile Youth Program in Moorhead. This program has housed 29 households so far for a total of 63 children. These households are comprised of parents who are working and in school, disabled, and some of the parents are even children themselves. All of their children deserve a chance to start a successful housing path and focus on their education instead of where to sleep at night. One of these families consists of a single mother who's working full-time as an administrative assistant at Cargill. She has four children. They were staying at the overflowing Churches United Homeless Shelter in Moorhead, where many of the families don't even have a room of their own to sleep in. Her children had no place to study and struggled to make it to their after-school activities. They are one of the lucky families that got into a pilot program through the Clay County HRA, and they are now living in a townhouse, and the children are able to complete all their homework each night at their own kitchen table. Further down our agenda, you'll see $1.5 million to increase Bridges. Bridges is a temporary modified Section 8 type program which provides rental subsidies for people with severe mental illness as they await permanent funding. I'd also like to point out that Bridges is in every single county that's represented in this room today by you. There are many Minnesotans who reach adulthood and go out on their own and struggle to keep a job or housing due to mental illness. People with mental illness put forth extraordinary effort to get better, but often keep falling through the cracks of society. Wilder's survey reports that 61% of people experiencing long-term homelessness have a mental illness. While homeless, it is a struggle to get better. Their medication is often stolen, they can't get a good night's sleep, and their therapist appointments are hard to make. With permanent, safe, and affordable housing, they can start the path to managing their illness, allowing them to be productive members of society. The $4.7 million increase to the Challenge Fund creates housing, which allows crucial workers to stay in our communities and fill necessary jobs. It takes many people to support a community. Those with low-skilled and low-paying jobs are integral to our society. All of us need janitors, bus drivers, cashiers to sell us gas and food, and these are the workers that need affordable workforce housing. Such housing allows workers to stay in our community and fill these necessary jobs. The Challenge Fund finances the creation of more workplace housing in Greater Minnesota. While it's important that we support those at the beginning of their housing path, those in the workforce, and those with children. We cannot forget that there are those that have surpassed their ability to work and are currently living on Social Security. Our agenda includes $1 million increase to the Single Family Rehab Program, which has made an incredible impact in allowing seniors in Greater Minnesota to stay in their communities that support them by allowing them to stay in their homes. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today, and if you have any questions, I will be available after the rest of the presenters.
Thank you for your good presentation. Next, we have Amanda Capps, Policy Coordinator for Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing. It's quite a title. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
My name is Amanda Kappas, and I'm Policy Coordinator for MICA, Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and I'd like to have Lachelle introduce herself also, please.
Lachelle, welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you, Director and members. I'm Lachelle Sims. I'm a lead coordinator with MICA. I'm also a member of the African American Leadership Forum, and I'm also outreach coordinator for the Black Veterans of America.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Gunther and committee members. I've just introduced myself, Amanda Kappas from MICA. As people of faith, we believe everyone without exception needs a decent, safe, accessible, and affordable home, which includes home ownership and rental options. We believe that our faith calls us to love and treat others as we treat ourselves. As a person who was born and raised in Greater Minnesota, I have a strong connection with our Greater Minnesota community members. I was born in Ada, which is in Norman County, so my early years in Barnesville, which is in Clay County, moved down to Le Sueur County and attended school in Cleveland, and then finished my education in Brainerd, which is in Crow Wing. So I have a strong connection throughout Greater Minnesota. I also have second and third generation family members that work for DigiKey, Marvin Windows, and Articat, which have testified earlier within this committee on issues with workforce housing in their areas. I'd like you to take a moment to look at your own district. In your packets, we provided these housing profiles. And on the second page, it will show you some documentation on how home ownership is the primary form of workforce housing in Greater Minnesota. Also, on the fact sheet in the three pages that we handed out in your packet, it looks like this. On the second page, according to the National Association of Home Builders, home ownership creates livable wage jobs, and providing home ownership opportunities creates workforce home ownership and increases community, state, and tax base. And in this little section here in the green, it shows us numbers about the average. When we build one average single-family home, how many jobs it creates, plus the tax dollars, building an average rental apartment, the job and tax dollars that creates, and then also remodeling. So it gives you a little idea of when we invest in home ownership and creation, that we're investing back into our community and creating tax dollars, which goes back into our state. According to the Minnesota Federal Reserve Bank, given the continued growth in the state's minority population, Minnesota's wide home ownership gap is of increasing concern for business, community, and political leaders. Increasing Minnesota's emerging market home ownership rate and closing the disparity gap will not only strengthen communities and help families build wealth, but it will also provide cost-benefit opportunities to social and economically for the state of Minnesota. And also on this fact sheet, there is some more details, but I know we're running short of time, so I'm sure you can review that. The National Association for Realtors states currently emerging markets make up 40% of first-time home buyers. Minnesota's emerging market population is growing faster than its white population, doubling to 12% between 1990 and 2000, and its buying power is growing at an amazing pace. As you have previously heard from Commissioner Mary Tingerthal, Minnesota has the third worst disparity in the nation for home ownership rates between Caucasian households and households of color. Providing long-term training, financial literacy, and connecting people with workforce development opportunities, which includes working with the workforce centers that we heard from earlier today, will assist households in to develop skills needed for jobs in the community and prepare them to access mortgage financing by addressing and increasing credit scores, access to alternative credit, which takes into consideration cultural and religious differences, but still meets all state and federal underwriting requirements to help close this gap. Home ownership provides stability for families, which in turn strengthens our community as a whole. The Housing Opportunities Made Equitable Home Law expands this opportunities for people of color, Hispanics, and American Indians, and Caucasians having difficulty obtaining first-time home ownership mortgages in Greater Minnesota. As families move into home ownership, it frees up current stock of rental workforce housing. This is a draft business plan from the Housing Opportunities Made Equitable Collaborative. It's for their 2015 to 2019. They are in the process of making their final draft, so once this is made public, we will ensure that all the committee members receive this. It is a tremendous business plan that has shown great success in working with the community colors within their own communities and working with the alternatives alternative financing and also with the long-term financial literacy programs to ensure that there is success with the home ownership. Build Wealth Minnesota is one of those agencies that has received financing from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency to build this program through their targeted mortgages. They have dealt with hundreds of families, and we are very proud to say that the 8 to 10 years that they've been working in with these types of programs, they have had zero defaults in any mortgage that they have processed, which in turn shows great success when we work with the long-term finance literacy programs and working on other issues that may cause hardship for home ownership. With that, if there's any questions, I'll answer them, or I'll just leave you to read through the information that is provided.
Thank you very much for a good testimony. Next we have Mona Langston. Welcome to our committee. She represents the Community Services Program Specialist at the State Council of Black Minnesotans. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify to you in front of you today. My name is Mona Langston, and I work with the Council on Black Minnesotans. And I want to testify in support of the Homes Law Investment and MHFA's Comprehensive Housing Plan. The Council on Black Minnesotans achieves its mission using community-driven decision-making through strict statewide community engagement. We also conduct independent research to develop and employ a strategic plan to fulfill our mandates as outlined by Minnesota Statute S3.9225. Our community engagement work this year resulted in the support of several administrative and legislative proposals, and today we are here to give our support to the home law investment legislation as it relates to workforce housing in Greater Minnesota and to MHFA's comprehensive housing plan that we heard here last week. We support the Home Investments Bill because statewide it will promote and support successful home ownership. It will prevent foreclosures and support community recovery statewide. It addresses specific needs in the rental housing market for workforce housing, and it preserves federally subsidized rental housing and prevents and ends homelessness in the long run. The Council also encourages support of MHFA's housing plan because it contains benchmarks that will include increased mortgage opportunities for communities of color for home ownership disparity reduction, increased participation of entities of color that provide home ownership counseling and other services, and increased participation of entities of color that produce housing units, all of which I think sort of rolls into what we heard from Dee today and from others last week about how these opportunity gaps sort of feed on each other and keep folks out of these sort of opportunities. So we strongly urge the support of the MHFA plan and the Homes Investment Bill because it will provide the tools necessary to achieve the statewide priorities our active members of the Council of Black Minnesotans approved over the past year. And I want to keep it short and simple, so I'm happy to take any questions, or we can you can reach me afterwards at the council. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for your good testimony.
Thank you.
Next we have Mark Brunner, President of Manufacturing Modular Home Association. Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Brunner. I'm with the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. And we represent the factory builders of, manufactured modular homes. Manufactured homes are built to federal building code. Modular homes are built to the state building code, both built in the same plant, same factory. Minnesota currently has 16 plants building manufactured modular homes. And you should have had in your packets just a brief outline about the industry in Minnesota today. We account for about 15% to 20% of all new single-family homes sold in the state of Minnesota. Nationally, that's about 30%. So we're a little behind in Minnesota in terms of the percentage of factory-built homes as a part of the total. A study on affordable housing options in Minnesota that was done a few years ago by the Minnesota Housing Partnership revealed that nearly 25% of all owner-occupied units considered affordable for Minnesota families earning less than half the area median income of approximately $34,000 were manufactured homes. So particularly in greater Minnesota, we have a more significant role in terms of meeting the needs of affordable workforce housing. And according to the Industrialized Building Commission, which is an organization that regulates modular homes that the state of Minnesota participates in through the Department of Labor and Industry, in the last quarter of 2012, Minnesota was the largest producer of new modular homes in the nation. And it wasn't necessarily because the housing market took off in Minnesota for modular homes, but you know, we're in a unique location in terms of being able to build homes that can be transported to western states and Canada, particularly with the shale mining that's been going on. So we've seen the number of plants increase to 16 in the state of Minnesota. Which and they're all again all located for the most part in greater Minnesota. There actually are a couple in the Twin Cities that are building modular homes, but the you know the ability for Minnesotans looking for affordable housing, particularly in greater Minnesota, in areas where you might not have a site builder or licensed contractors to purchase a new manufactured home or modular home, have it transported to the home site, installed on a basement or a foundation by one of our licensed contractors or installers, you know, we feel can play a significant role in terms of helping to meet the workforce housing shortage that we're experiencing in the state today. We employ between 3,500 and 4,000 employees statewide. Some of those would be the managers and owners of the state's nearly 1,000 licensed manufactured home communities in Minnesota. These are properties where a homeowner wouldn't own their land but would lease the home site. There are approximately 50,000 families that live in manufactured home communities in the state of Minnesota, yet we probably sell 75% of our homes that are placed on private property or in subdivisions in the state. So the the need that we're meeting isn't all just focused in manufactured home communities, but more broadly to homes that are placed on scattered sites throughout the state. And typically a new manufactured or modular home will cost 15 to 20% less than a traditional site-built home for various reasons. Just the ability to build a home in a plant that's in a protected environment, climatically controlled. We don't have the loss of materials through theft on the home site, which typically accounts for about 5% of the cost of a new home. So there are a number of advantages that we have building in a factory. And really just wanted to make the committee aware that we would very much like to be a part of the proposals that are moving forward through this committee in helping to address the workforce housing shortage need. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And next we have Hector Garcia, Executive Director of the Chiquino Latino Affairs Council. Welcome to our committee. Please give your name for the record.
Hector Garcia, Executive Director of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. Thank you, Chair Gunther, and members of the committee for inviting me to present. And I am one of the, I represent one of the four ethnic state agencies which perform the role of being bridges of communication and collaboration between government and our respective communities. And I think this is very pertinent in what is being discussed today because our community was one of the most affected by the foreclosure crisis, as you know, I believe, and by several other disparities which are among the worst in the nation. I share the feelings of the Deputy Commissioner Hansen, who spoke about branding. And I often think that the Latino branding challenge is part of the problem. I think we need to communicate better in order to reduce the disparities in several areas. In particular, I wanted to speak to you today about the bill that you're considering having as a companion to SF 282. I think it's extremely important that the home workforce investment that needs to be done be carried out. The University of Minnesota demonstrated that there was a 12-to-1 return on investment. And so the investment that ends up being made will definitely have an impact on the population of Latinos. You might recall that between 2000 and 2010, our population grew by 75% in Minnesota, while the European American population grew by 1.6%. And as Deed mentioned earlier, there are 500,000 persons leaving the workforce over the next 10 years. If we don't do something about empowering those populations which are growing very rapidly, namely our own, the Asian population, as well as the African American, I'm afraid that the future is not going to look very good. And so every disparity is interconnected. This is connected to economic development, to education, to health, and therefore I believe that it needs to be taken into consideration very strategically, and I hope you will give me the opportunity to speak before your committee on innovative ways in which we can reduce the disparities considerably. I think, again, using some of the language used by Deputy Commissioner Hansen, he talked about perception and reality, communication. There are a lot of misperceptions about our community and the other immigrant communities. we can be the same engine of economic growth that immigrants have been throughout the history of this nation, but there needs to be better communication between the majority and the minorities, by far better than the one we have today. And I'm glad Representative Norton's here, because she knows that we've invested a great deal of time in Rochester, where we find that there is by far better communication between our community and the majority community. Not necessarily because the population there is different in any way, but because it's a small city and people see the undocumented farmer who doesn't speak English and might drive without a license, but they also see the engineers and executives at IBM. They see the doctors and researchers who are Latinos at the Mayo Clinic. They see the Latin Americans who come for yearly treatments at the Mayo Clinic, and they see the multiple business owners that exist. And so they don't go by what they read in the crime section of the newspapers. They see who we are. And so when you have time, I would very much like to talk to you at length, as I am going to do tomorrow to the Republican caucus in the Senate. Thank you, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you for coming here today.
Thank you very much.
And we have one more, Dan Larson. Can you get done quickly?
Mr. Chair, members, Dan Larson, representing the Minnesota Rural Counties Caucus, 29 counties in greater Minnesota. I am the administrator for the MRCC. So here briefly to emphasize the need and demonstrate support for the effort to provide relief to the significant limiting factor that a lack of workforce housing imposes on solid businesses in greater Minnesota. We're staying close to the strong efforts and leadership both of the League of Minnesota Cities and Greater Minnesota Partnership, and understand the committee is going to have some decisions to make as the session progresses. But at this point, the MRCC wants to be on record in recognition of the need to address workforce housing and in appreciation of this committee's effort to do so.
Thank you very much. Very well chosen words. Any member have any question they would like to ask anybody that's still around? Don't see any. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you very much for your